Good afternoon. We'll open the subcommittee on public safety this afternoon. Today is February 14th. Happy birthday to the Capitol. And welcome to this afternoon on CJC. And we will open up a public hearing on CJC, House Bill 5005. And we'll call up both. I think last week, Mr. Schmidt, you were referred to as the genius of all things data, I think is what was referred to. And we'll go ahead and invite up Dustin Ball. I don't have a fun thing for you at the same time, but I'm sure you're just as brilliant. So take it away, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, members of the Public Safety Subcommittee. My name is Mike Schmidt, the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I wore my Valentine's Day tie today, but Representative Barker has yet again outclassed me.
Yeah, that's right.
Senator Frederick.
As well as Senator Frederick. So I will dive right in, Mr. Chair, if you want. Should people take questions as we go or just get through it?
If that works for you guys, then that would be ideal.
That's fine. All right. So starting with the overview of the Criminal Justice Commission, our duties and mission is laid out in statute. We are to improve the legitimacy, the efficiency, and effectiveness of the state and local criminal justice systems. And we are to work on public safety plans for the state and work with the counties. So that really kind of drives the majority of the work we do. We are a commission. These are the current commissioners of the CJC. We have a representative and a senator. Senator Pruszanski and Representative Stark are our two legislative commissioners. And then you can see from the rest of our commissioners, we have a pretty good geographic distribution around the state represented, all the way down to Josephine County and Clark, and all around this area as well. Our key performance measures that we track, we look at customer satisfaction, which for us as an agency that administers grants is essentially working with our partners who take those grants and see how they rate us. We had a very high satisfaction rate in 2015, is 97% rating us as good or excellent. And the second key performance measure has to do more with people attending programs and using their grant funds. And so there, again, we met our goals. We're a small agency. I know sometimes it doesn't feel that way, at least to us, but we only have staff of 11 FTE. We have a couple of extra folks helping us out right now, but full-time employees of 11, and we pretty much split the house between grant analysts and researchers, and we have three of each. So that pretty much drives all the work that we do. And these are our six areas of focus, and I'll spend a lot of time in each of those, but the first and biggest program that we have at the Criminal Justice Commission is the Justice Reinvestment Program. It started with legislation in 2013. With House Bill 3194, as Senator Winters is, and many of you, but was one of the founding members of that legislation. And so then we also administer specialty courts. That's our other biggest program. The Criminal Justice Commission has been doing that since 2005. And then the rest of our areas of focus are planning and policy. Like I said, we do a lot of research. We work with this body. We work with the governor's office to study and prioritize public safety programs. We administer the sentencing guidelines for the state, so anytime the legislature amends or creates a new criminal law, it is up to our commissioners to rank the crime severity of that, which dictates the sentence that will be imposed by the court. We house the state's Statistical Analysis Center, which is a federal grant that we receive that allows us to do a lot of the statistical work that we do around criminal justice statistics, and we staff the Asset Oversight and Forfeiture Committee. So starting out with justice reinvestment, like I said, this is currently our biggest program area. The four goals in the legislation for justice reinvestment were to reduce prison populations, reduce recidivism, increase public safety, and increase offender accountability. The graphic that you have there is from a dashboard that we have on our website, and I'll take a little bit of time in a minute to show you some of the dashboards that we have that we've built around justice reinvestment. But this dashboard shows you that in this current biennium, $38.7 million went out to the counties in the form of public safety grants. 10% of that money was targeted towards nonprofit community-based victim service organizations, and 3% was held for researching. And we have four different studies currently underway of programs that have been funded by Justice Reinvestment, so we can ensure that the money that's being spent is being allocated efficiently and in to effective programs. This is one of the ways, and probably one of the most intensive areas of the way that we administer this grant. We call it our RICS. And so quarterly, since 2013, the CJC has been getting folks from LIPSICS across the state together to talk about their local criminal justice statistics. And when I first started with the CJC right after 3194 was passed, I mean, we go out to the counties, we're hosted by one of the counties to have the meeting, members from all the regional LIPSICS get together, and we just go county by county, and we look at how much prison are you using? Is it going up? Is it going down? And what areas are you using it? We look at revocations. We look at every way you can think to slice it. We're looking at it so that they can be informed about how they stack up next to their peer counties, how they look across the state, if they're out of step or if they're in line, if they're above or below statewide averages. And so we've been doing that for the last 3 years now, is just going out quarterly and having those meetings and sharing data information. I think it's really one of the reasons that this has been such an effective program, is because before this was happening, nobody knew. I mean, nobody knew how much prison they were using as a county or their local criminal justice system. It wasn't tracked in that way. There was no way for you to compare yourself to other counties or to other jurisdictions, even peer jurisdictions that you would say were similar to you. There was no good way to do that, and so we were kind of flying blind. So this, it seems kind of like a small thing, but just getting folks the data and the information so that they can critically evaluate their own public safety systems, I think has been absolutely crucial.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
I don't know if this is the right time to ask this question. If it's not, feel free to tell me later. But one of the questions that I would have is, these kinds of data are critically important. As Senator Winters will attest, we've been talking about the need for evidence and data nonstop in the Human Services Subcommittee, and of course it's equally relevant here. But one of the questions that I have, obviously, is how are we doing, what's the efficacy of some of our diversion programs? You know, when you have drug courts or other kinds of specialty courts, how well are they doing county by county? When you have people who come out of prison or jail because they had a sentence of less than a year, what kinds of treatment have they been getting? What kinds of treatment are they getting? Because we know about the intersection between addiction and criminal behavior. Are you able to get those data as well and track people going forward or backward? Do you have a way to do that adequately?
Mr. Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, not to that level of minutia at the statewide level. With our Justice Reinvestment Program, all 36 counties have 36 different approaches that they've taken to meet those four goals. So we can work with a county specifically to look at discrete programs. We can look at the countywide recidivism rates. And so the way we're able to break it down, I can tell you Multnomah County or Clackamas, but if you wanted to look at a specific treatment program or a specific type of offender population that was getting out of prison and going into, we don't quite have that level of specificity yet at the statewide level.
Mr. Treifeld, if I may. Thank you. Thanks. That's really helpful. What are your barriers to getting that specific? I guess because I'm saying that, you know, you're already saying how valuable the counties are finding it to see how they compare to other counties in terms of their use of prison and how many percentage-wise what they're sending and the lengths of sentences and all that kind of stuff. But I would think that they'd also want to know which treatment programs, for example, are the most effective and really keep people sober in the long term. So what are your barriers?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward. You know, I think it's possible to do. What we're not doing right now is getting the when we look at offenders and we're tracking recidivism rates and we put people in the cohorts, we look at their state identification number, or what we call the SID number. And that really is the way that we follow people through the criminal justice system and see if they end up being arrested again or see if they end up being convicted or incarcerated. So if we had the SID numbers going into specific treatment programs, it'd be very easy for us to track those numbers and then track outcomes by program. So it's a matter of getting who is going through those treatment programs and being able to follow them through the system. Right now, we know at a county level who the SID numbers are being released from prison and going into the counties, but I don't have a way to find out which treatment programs, which numbers are going through. But it's a, in my mind, it's a doable problem that we could overcome.
Man, it kind of begs the question about why can't you get that information?
Yeah, Representative Stark, Senator Steiner-Hayward, it certainly does beg that question. You know, I think in talking to local counties, you know, it's a matter of contracts and reporting and getting treatment agencies to report on who it is that are going through their programs. So probably some folks from the county level would be able to talk about their relationships with treatment providers and what the barriers and challenges would be to that. But it seems like something that could be doable.
Senator Winters, you're dying to say something.
No, I just wanted to pile on just a little bit because, you know, it's part of that conversation that we had in Human Services of particularly alcohol and drug treatment, mm-hmm. of not knowing actually what is. Mm-hmm. Director Schmidt, we've talked about this in a broader range of talking about, one, the issue of identification of how much money from the various sources that's going into drug alcohol treatment. Two, how many providers do we have and contracts that are out there? Three, what are the outcomes or what is the best model that exists? So, you know, those are some of the pieces, even before we could get to where you want to go, because we don't even know the full range yet. And I know, you know, I raised this Human Services sub, that we've got to begin to have a better understanding of knowing what resources that are there. Collectively, because it's more than just in one pot, and then what are the providers in those contracts that are out there, and then what are the outcomes? Because if I talk to on the public safety side, and you went to the county level and talked to some of my sheriffs and law enforcement, they will tell you that that finding resources can also be problematic in providing those services that they need in order to provide for the wraparound for their clientele. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I.
So, Mike, before you continue, you've mentioned Lipsick a couple times. For anyone who's new in this room, we'll give a 30-second, you know, overview of what that is.
Yeah, Chair Stark, sorry about that. Right, LPSC, the acronym for Local Public Safety Coordinating Council. It's in statute. Every county has one. It's made up by specific members who are named in the statute that need to be at that Local Public Safety Coordinating Council. And, in fact, we have some experts sitting behind me and to the right, or to my right, who are right now currently working with AOC, Association of Counties, and CJC on a federal grant that we procured to put staff into LPSICs across the state. And so we have not all counties, because we didn't have a big enough grant to do that, but in 16 counties now we have some professionalized staff to help LPSICs do their work, because all the members of a LPSIC, like I said, you've got your district attorney, you've got a judge, public defender, they all have, you know, day jobs, right? They're really busy people. So having someone there to kind of staff that group and help them carry the ball forward from meeting to meeting, we think is just absolutely crucial in being able to look objectively at your public safety system and analyze data and do studies and investigate what works and what's working locally. So I hope maybe they'll be able to come up and talk to you about their experience, but we're really excited about that program. We think it'll be a huge step forward for counties as they continue to dig in on this work. Thank you, Representative Stark, for the question. So the RIC meetings, Regional Information Councils, or Implementation Councils, this really was our way to interface with the counties and give them the data that they need to see if justice reinvestment is working. And you can see we broke up the state into four different regions. That was mainly so we didn't have to have 36 different meetings. But we tried to put people together with like and similar counties so that they kind of are used to working together anyway. So, you know, one of the questions immediately is, of course, how are you doing with justice reinvestment? And so what you can see here is that statewide intakes are down, and we're measuring January 2015 to December 2015 compared to 2016. So basically 2015 to 2016. And in that, in the last year, statewide intakes are down by 243 individuals. And when you look at this graph, you can see that the majority of those are coming out of the property and the drug areas. The person intakes are relatively flat. Other intakes are a little bit up. Sex type offenses are a little bit down. But all of the decrease is coming in property and drug intakes, and that's exactly where the justice reinvestment programs have focused all of their efforts and where the LIPSICs and the counties have really dug into this program. So that's exactly what we would hope we would see. And then this is really the graph about where we were, where we thought we were going to be, and where we are. And so you can see by the green line on the top, in 2013, when the justice reinvestment legislation conversation was happening, it was because Oregon was faced with building a new prison. We were on the precipice of having to build a new prison in Junction City to be able to house the projected increase in inmates. And that's what the green line represents. That is the forecast from April 2013 that this body was looking at and saying, okay, by the time we get to 2017, right here where this line crosses the green line, that's where we need to have a prison ready to open, staffed, built, functional, ready to go. And so at that time, you know, that was the conversation was, we want to avoid that happening. What can we do to make that happen? And what came out of that conversation was the justice reinvestment legislation, which had some sentencing changes, some modest sentencing changes, and then also the grant component. The biggest sentencing change that probably some of you are familiar with is the short-term transitional leave change, which allows somebody to spend the last 90 days of their prison sentence in the community that they'd be being released to anyway 90 days later. So it allows them to spend that time. We are just about to release, the Criminal Justice Commission, our second study to kind of get to one of Senator Steiner-Hayward's questions about measuring the efficacy of programs. We've been tracking that population very closely and comparing those who received the short-term trans leave 90 days to those who did not receive the short-term trans leave 90 days. And we're seeing a statistically significant reduction in recidivism between those two cohorts when we compare them side to side, essentially meaning that we're seeing folks who are getting the short-term trans leave recidivate less than those who are not.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you. I'm not blindsiding Mr. Schmidt with this question, but I think it's important to get on the record because he and I have had this conversation. If I understand the conversations we've had before about this issue, and you know that I'm a strong proponent of the short-term transitional leave program. In fact, I have a bill to increase the length of that. My concern is that when you're comparing people who got out against people who didn't, well, there are reasons they didn't. Their behavior wasn't sufficiently well-controlled. They weren't following the rules, and therefore they were ineligible. Almost by definition, people who aren't able to behave themselves in a controlled environment like prison seem much more at risk for recidivism than people who are able to control themselves in a controlled environment. And so I guess my question is, do we have the capacity to get data on people who prior to 2013 would have been eligible for 90 days of leave, but that wasn't an option for them, and what their recidivism rate is or was compared to people who have been eligible and did take advantage of the 90 days of short-term trans leave? Because that's really an apples-to-apples comparison. So I feel pretty strongly that if we want to convince people that this is a good idea, we need to be comparing analogous groups,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, we try to do our best to do a comparison. Whenever you're comparing two groups, and Senator and I have had this conversation, you can't just set up an experiment, right? You want to do a randomized controlled trial like you would do for a drug trial. Some people get a placebo, some people get the intervention, and then you see if it works or not. Well, you'd like to do that in criminal justice. But when you're talking about releasing people from prison, you have ethical issues with hey, you get out 90 days early, you don't. So the trial, to actually do a controlled trial, would not be possible in this situation. What Senator Steiner Hayward's talking about is trying to find a match group who would have existed and would have gotten the intervention previous to 3194, but didn't because it didn't exist yet. We have tried to do that analysis. It's extremely challenging for us because since House Bill 3194 passed, DOC was tasked with finding the people who would be eligible for this program and getting them signed up and then working with counties and making sure that they have housing and making sure they have services so that they could actually transition out into the community. Because that work wasn't being done previous to 3194, we don't have who was eligible or who would have gone out because we don't know who would have had those resources and had those plans. We tried to get at it, and Senator, I can
we can have that conversation a little more, but I think maybe you think I'm asking for more than I'm asking for.
So I don't
want to belabor the point here, but I think it's important to be clear about it. Because there were only certain crimes, right, that were, and certain lengths of sentence and things like that, that would have been eligible. And you know how people's behavior was, and you certainly know who got out on 30 days of trans leave, which was available prior to the implementation of 3194. So that, at some level, is an analogous population, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Steinhardt, yes.
Thank you.
Just follow, Mr. Chair, Director Smith, maybe you might want to also explain some of the reach-in and some of the activity that's involved with trans leaves, because it's just not talking about within 90 days you're let out to actually go sin no more. That is not what happens, and I don't want the public to think that's what happens. And prior to 3194. I mean, so talk about what really happens with trans leave and 3194.
Yeah, Chair Stark, Co-Chair Senator Winters. What really happens with the short-term transitional leave population is, the Department of Corrections, first of all, identifies who would be eligible, which, like Senator Steiner Hayward alluded to, meant that there were certain crimes that are eligible, certain crimes, if you had a mandatory sentence, you would not be eligible. So the first step is, are you serving an eligible crime? And then from there, Department of Corrections looks at your performance within the institution. Have you been compliant? Are you doing treatment? Are you doing the things that you're supposed to be doing internally and not having any kind of behavioral issues that would otherwise make you ineligible for a transitional leave program? Once they have done that and determined that you, in fact, are an eligible person, then it goes out to the counties. And then they start to work with the release counselor and having a conversation with the counties. And some of the counties, in fact, many of the counties actually reach into the Department of Corrections and start having conversations with the offender who will eventually be released. So they start establishing that relationship before the person actually leaves the Department of Corrections. And from there, it's up to the county to determine, do we have the resources in place? Housing is a must-have. A person cannot just be released to nothing. If there is not a place for them to have housing, then they cannot be eligible for the trans leave program. So then the county also looks at what other type of transitional and wraparound services are available that we can continue this person as soon as they get out to make sure that they can be successful in the community. Like I said, the recidivism rate is very promising for that group. And so that it's kind of a whole package of following somebody from being eligible and then making sure that their communication with the counties. And the counties ultimately get to choose and have say in who comes back into their communities.
Representative Parker.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. And one other thing is, would seem to me, and you can correct me if I'm not correct about this, but in the last few years, we've really been asking the counties not to send people to prison as much as they can, and the sheriffs, parole and probation, and the DAs have really been working hard. So that would make, I think, something of a shift would make it very difficult to compare, to find a group you could say that's the same as now because of the effort on the front end not to be putting in people in that door. Am I correct?
Yeah, Chair Stark, Representative Barker. Yeah, we are definitely in a different climate post-3194. This program could not work without everybody participating and, you know, having being a part of making it successful. So, yeah, it's
and us getting money back to the community corrections.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they can continue their good work. Thank you.
And I know we'll have more on this conversation when DOC is here, and, you know, we can dive further into the details on that. So, let's continue.
All right, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you can see here, like I said, the green line is where we were projected to go when the legislation was passing. The black line is where we've actually done, and this is the male prison population. And the next slide breaks out the female prison population because it's a slightly separate issue. But what you can see is that since 2013, more, you know, with a little bit of ups and a little bit of down, the prison population has been relatively flat now for 3 going on 4 years. If you start from 2013 and go to 2017, we've really been hovering around 13,400. If you look back, and on the Criminal Justice Commission website, you can go farther back into the old prison population. There's not another time period that mirrors this where you see that stagnant, no growth trajectory. So, you know, I think that is just a testament to the grant programs and the sentencing changes. And the way that we can be confident about that is when we look at the prison populations, like I showed you on the previous slide, it's coming out of the drug and the property offenders, which is exactly the type of programs that the counties are working on and the offenders that they're targeting.
Senator Frederick?
Yes, thank you. I'm curious whether there is a, if you go back in time, mm-hmm. whether there are the kinds of spikes that we see right at the very beginning of that, that dark line there in terms of the prison population. So that, I mean, whether we saw spikes in the 80s or whatever, I don't know how far back you go, but it would be interesting to see what was causing those spikes at that time.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Frederick, that's a great segue to the Criminal Justice Commission website.
Aha.
So, in fact, you can go back. This goes back to 2003, but right you can here. Go all the way back. We have it back to 1994. Mm-hmm. And so here is the prison. The black line represents the actual prison population. And so you can kind of see that this area at the top has been the longest flat area over any time period here. We had a dip back here in from 97 to 98, but then a steep increase from there. So, yeah, I mean, there is kind of this up and down that happens.
Follow up.
I'm wondering, were we concentrating more, and I suspect that this is the case, were we concentrating more on drug crimes at that particular time, or were we concentrating more on property crimes? Was there something that sparked that particular spike in arrests and convictions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Frederick, are you referring
right
to
there, or frankly, from that point all the way up there? What was going on in that short period of time?
Yeah,
that's
so,
how many years? I can't see the bottom of that.
That goes all the way back to, I think, 1994.
No, but I'm talking, go to about 98 there, mm-hmm. 98 or 97, December of 97, all the way up to 2007. What were we doing?
Yeah, so there's, Mr. Chair, Senator Frederick, you know, I think there's, it's a very complicated question, but it's really a lot of policy changes and sentencing changes that have happened between now and then, combined with resource changes in the state. Resources always play a part in how the public safety system works in terms of enforcement of laws, like you said, focusing on drug crimes, focusing on property crimes. So between 1997 and 2013, you know, you had really a lot of the mandatory minimum sentences coming into effect and taking hold around Measure 11. And then back in 2008 is where Measure 57 came on. So those are policy decisions that were made, by the people to change the sentences. That certainly has an effect on our prison population. So it's kind of a all of those things lead. There's also general population growth in the state of Oregon, which will have an impact. So it's kind of a bunch of different things happening at once. But policy and sentencing changes are big players in prison population.
I would be curious to see what those policy changes were and how they affected the system.
Senator Stander Hayward?
Really good question. Given the flatness of our population for the past 4 years, basically, or 3.5 years, why is your projected population still going up at the rate it is? Why hasn't your forecast changed?
Representative Starks, Senator Steiner Hayward, that really is a reflection of population growth. Okay. When we're forecasting, the Office of Economic Analysis, who does the prison forecast, factors in population growth, and especially they look at the male population in that 18 to 25, 30 range, and they look at the size of that and make projections based on that. So I think that's just the general upward tick that you see.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Continue.
Okay. And so then this is the female prison population forecast. And you can see we broke it out similarly. The green line is where we were before 2013, where we were projected to go. The black line is where we've actually been, and the blue line is the most current prison population forecast. That dotted line is the OSPM minimum facility, and that, of course, is the threshold that the Department of Corrections has said at which they need more capacity to operate. So you can see that we have been above that line for, you know, pretty much the last year. We've been up and down and hovering just around that line. I'll note that when House Bill 3194 was passed, we weren't looking at the male and female prison populations discreetly. We were really looking at them as one entire prison population. But once the Coffee Creek facility was reaching its maximum point, it became clear that we needed to look at them as different populations that have different resource demands. So that's when we started breaking out the female forecast and the male forecast. It's a little unfortunate because I think if we would have looked at them discreetly when the legislation was passed, we could have talked through that issue then. But, you know, certainly since that's happened, there's been a lot of work on this. And yet again, the Justice Reinvestment Program has kind of brought all those folks to the table. And so you have counties that are stepping up, like Marion County, for example. I saw the sheriff sitting back there. They just opened a transition work program targeting women. So, I mean, the counties, because we're tracking the numbers and the data, are able to dig in and work on issues that the state is facing. So we're hopeful that when the next forecast comes out, when we look at this female population, that we might not have to open OSPM because of work that the counties are doing using justice reinvestment, but also just using the relationships that they've built, not only with this program, but with each other internally in the counties.
Mr. Chair, I need to do a shout out because, you know, I talked about this being a system, you know, at one of our hearings. And so when this population trend, and I need to thank the counties, and not only, you know, my share, but you have the DAs and the parole and probation officers and others that are in the community who are stepping forward to help us change this this trajectory. So I need to say that because, then, you know, often we think, and sometimes we think in isolation, and it took, you know, everyone at the table to talk about what we needed to do, one, to keep the community safe, but two, in order to change the population trends so that we weren't building another prison or opening up, you know, my old OWCC. So I for the record, I want to thank all of you that have been involved, that have worked on this issue. And I know it's more now than just Marion County, Lane County, Klamath County. You know, Multnomah County has talked about opening beds. So I do, and I know it's more than just my sheriff. It's your DAs and your chiefs and others who have been involved in this discussion and conversation. So,
yeah, Mr. Chair. To echo Senator Winters, You know, I bring up the Marion County example, but it's really all across the state. Lipsicks and counties are having these conversations and are willing partners and working with us to try to, you know, continue this justice reinvestment program. It's really had a great effect. I mean, Jackson County is also looking at a work release program and others. And other counties have tried to tackle these issues in their own ways. So it's really been a great statewide effort to make this happen. So reduction of recidivism is one of the four goals of the justice reinvestment legislation. And so we track that very closely. And so I just want to take a quick second, and I've already jumped out to our dashboards once, but just kind of show you how we are tracking recidivism. So this is our interactive dashboard page. You can go on here to find justice reinvestment prison usage. We look at prison use for all different crime types. So if you were interested in some of just prison at large, you could look at that. Short-term transitional leave. If you want to look at how counties are spending their justice reinvestment funds, on the Justice Reinvestment County Program dashboard, you can literally click on your county and see exactly how much money they got and where they invested it, what their priorities were. But I want to show you the recidivism dashboard, because this is one of the four goals of the program, like I said. And so we have built this dashboard that allows anybody to go on and look at recidivism rates across the state. And it's completely interactive. So if you click on arrest, for example, in the parole group, the average time for those who are arrested within 3 years is 10.4 months. Compare that to the probation group, where it's 10.7 months. It's just some high-level information. We break it out by race, by risk level, by gender, of statewide recidivism rates. And I should go back. House Bill 3194 changed the definition of recidivism in the state of Oregon. It used to be a conviction within 3 years, a felony conviction within 3 years. Now, because of House Bill 3194, it's an arrest for a new crime, a conviction for a new crime, or incarceration for a new crime. So that does include misdemeanors. So if you're thinking back to recidivism rates pre-3194, these numbers are going to look very different to you because we changed that definition.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
So actually that points out another reason why comparing the population before 3194 recidivism, because we've actually made the definition of recidivism stricter. So, okay. Helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward. We did, but we also figured that out. So we, this next dashboard.
I wasn't surprised you figured it out, Mr. Schmidt.
We're able to go back. So we retroactively have applied our new definition of recidivism to all the cohorts going back to 1996. So although you almost helped me out, I re-dug myself into that same problem. But we can go back all the way to 1996 and see recidivism rates over time. And so this dashboard, what it shows you is if you wanted to zoom into a closer time period, you could do that. And this is the statewide recidivism rates. And so those three lines represent the three definitions. The blue line is arrest, the gold line is conviction, and the bottom line is incarceration. We could change the cohort to either look at parole or look at probation or look at both. We can look at, break it out by crime category, risk level, gender, age, all of those things. But what I think is really cool and useful is that you can click on your county specifically and very quickly see how you compare to the statewide recidivism rates locally and also to your regional comparators. So you see we highlighted this region of the larger counties so that when I click on Marion County, it immediately compares Marion County to those other same counties so that they can kind of see of our region, how do we compare versus how do we compare to the statewide rates? So, you know, folks and the sheriff or the DA can talk about this in Marion County because their LIPSIC is extremely active here in Marion County. But our hope is that this is the type of information that they can track very closely. We keep it completely up to date. So every 6 months, there's new cohort information on this. And they can see very quickly if the interventions and the public safety programs that they are trying to work on are having a difference one way or another on recidivism rates. again, this is kind of a first time ever where people can access this information. Anybody in the public can access this information and have conversations about recidivism in their county compared to statewide rates. So we're really excited about this. And if we were to continue to go through this dashboard, you can cut this information and data, you know, 10 different ways. So I'll continue on with the presentation. So this is our Justice Reinvestment Grant Program. Like I said, it started in 2013. And so what we did, I took this chart off of a report that the Commission and the Department of Corrections worked on together, a cost avoidance report that we sent to the legislature at the beginning of the year. We have to do one of these every 2 years. But that's where this chart comes from. And what you can see essentially in here is how much we were projected to save in 2013. So we're kind of comparing ourselves to what we thought we would save in 2013, what we're actually saving now that we've seen the data come in, and then how much funding has been invested in this program. So you can see in 2013, we were projected to save $18 million. Now that we actually we've made it through that biennium, we know how many people came to prison, we know what happened, we can see and look back that the avoided cost to the state was a little over $12 million. And the legislature invested that biennium $15 million into the justice reinvestment programs. Okay, then you go to the current biennium that we're in. In 2013, we were projecting to save $66 million. Now that we have hindsight, we're almost through this biennium. We have a pretty good grasp on how many people actually came to prison for what areas. We can say that we think the actual savings is going to be very close to $50 million, 51.4 in this chart. And then what the legislature invested in this biennium into these programs was $38.7 million into grants to the counties.
So, Mike, on that, so when I'm looking at the difference between $13 million and $15 million and 51 and 38, are you saying that you saved, you know, $12.8 million after having spent the 15? So is that included in? That's the difference between what we invested and what we saved? Or is it that we invested 15 and only saved 13?
Chair Stark, yeah. Your question makes sense. It's a little confusing. What we're actually comparing here is when this body was considering passing the justice reinvestment legislation in 2013, that first column is what we were projecting the savings to be. So we thought we would save $18 million. Now that we can look back, because we're sitting here in 2017, and see how many people actually came to prison, we can look back and say, okay, what we actually saved was $12 million, $12.8 million, right? The investment was $15 million.
So I get the concept here.
Okay.
I'm trying to make sure that, so we invested 15 and then saved that and another 15? Or did we lose money the first year?
Lost money the first year.
Okay, I'm just making sure I'm reading that appropriately.
Yep, exactly right. So the first year, the legislature invested slightly more than when we look back what we actually avoided in costs. When you look to the second year, you can see that to lose money to make money, you made money the second year.
Yeah.
The legislature invested 38.7. We're projecting at this moment that we will have actually avoided the state $51 million in costs that you would have had to spend. Back in 2013, when we were projecting, we thought it would be $66 million. So it was less than what we were projecting, but still more than was invested. And now is the year that this is the biennium that we get to the big savings. So you'll remember when I was showing the forecast lines, 2017 was the biennium that the legislature was going to have to build Junction City. And so at the time, that was spread out across in 2013 when we were originally forecasting it. But looking at it now, 2017 is where you would have had to build it, and it would have cost the state $190 million to both build and operate that facility, if you were to do it all at one time, of course. And so the governor's recommended budget, and this says $32.3 million. That's actually an error. It's supposed to be $31.9 million. That's my fault. The governor's recommended budget for the Justice Reinvestment Grant Program is $31.9 million. So that's the Justice Reinvestment Program. Now we have the specialty court program.
Are there other questions on that before we go on?
And I know there's a lot of folks behind me, Mr. Chair, that are here to talk about just reinvestment and specialty court, so I'll try to move faster.
We keep having a lot of questions.
I won't ask any questions.
I'll restrain myself.
So the specialty court program is CJC's other significant grant program that we operate. We fund 36 different specialty courts across the state. We're not in every single county, but we're in the majority of counties. We have specialty courts is kind of an umbrella term. The most prolific of those would be your adult drug courts, but we also fund veterans courts, mental health courts, family, juvenile courts. So it is kind of a broader capturing term. But the majority of those are the drug courts. And so in 15 to 17, we spent $15.2 million to fund the 36 courts across 22 counties. The CJC works in coordination with the Chief Justice and Judicial Department to work on standards, uniform standards for best practices across drug courts. It's a challenging thing because there are multiple different types of courts, so we're working on what are the best practices and standards for, say, a veterans court versus an adult drug court versus a mental health court, because they're discrete populations, so they are different standards. But that's something that we're working with the Judicial Department to do. We do a robust peer review. So we work with volunteers from across the state to go out and sit in on these specialty courts and see how they're operating and then give them feedback so they can both the reviewers learn from that process, but also those being reviewed get feedback from folks who operate drug courts in their own jurisdictions but can share information and look at best practices and just kind of be another way to share information so that people are doing good work on that. So we're very proud of our peer review program. We peer reviewed, I think, in this biennium, I believe over 22 courts, somewhere around there. So we work to peer review all the courts. And so that's been a really great program. And then the specialty court database, currently the specialty courts used to have a uniform database that could all work together. We could get data from all of them, which is a great way for us to determine how effective they are at reducing recidivism and what kind of results we're getting. Unfortunately, the database that we used to have is kind of defunct at this point with all the different upgrades to Odyssey from OGIN and just Windows to whatever Windows we're at now. You know, the old program is just completely outdated. So the courts, it's not very a useful program anymore. We can't draw data from it. In fact, a lot of courts have just kind of gone to keeping data by spreadsheet at this point. So that is something that we are working to look at procuring another system that would once again give drug courts one unified system that we could have information and do research and study and get outcomes. This was the specialty courts grant program over the year in terms of funding. You can see that it's grown over the years. In 9 to 11, the general fund was right around $3 million, about the same in 11 to 15. 13 to 15, it was general fund was over $6 million. In this last biennium, it was $12 million. In the governor's requested budget, it's in the $9 million range. There are other funds that go into this. So like I said, the Criminal Justice Commission staffs the Asset Forfeiture Committee. 20% of the asset forfeiture money goes to specialty courts in Oregon. So that is one of our areas to fund drug courts. We're projecting to put $906,000 into drug courts from the asset forfeiture money. Federal funds, we wrote to be determined on there. CJC GITS is the recipient of several different federal funds, the most notable of which is the Burnt Bag grants, where we have been getting about $2 million a year. That is a little bit more in the air than it used to be in terms of just with the transition of the federal government or the new administration. We have concerns around how stable that funding source will be, if it'll continue. So it's something that we are watching very closely, but it definitely any decreases to those federal funds would impact how much we're able to allocate to our drug courts and to our specialty courts.
And Mike, I just discovered we have 10 people to testify still today, and we've asked you a lot of questions, so highlights are probably ideal for most of the rest of this.
Got it. So very quickly, planning and policy development, the rest will go very fast. This is the Oregon Knowledge Bank, and I just want to take one quick second to show you. This is a project that we worked on with DPSST. This is a joint project, and the idea is really a straightforward and simple one. It's to share information among law enforcement on what works and what are you doing and what challenges are you facing locally. And I'll just kind of give you an idea of the functionality of it very quickly. You can scroll down here, and let's say you're a police officer in Oregon, so you click on policing programs. And so whatever the issue is that you're trying to problem solve for, you can go into this and say that you're interested in mental illness in your community and what are other jurisdictions doing. You can click on this, and it quickly sorts 8 different programs that are being tried by policing agencies across Oregon. And so I'll click on the Mobile Crisis Response Team. What we're endeavoring to do is just give high-level information. This is user-generated content. So the Marion County Sheriff's Office gave us this information about a program that they have and just answered some simple questions. What was the problem you were trying to address? What is the solution that you came up with? And what outcomes and advice do you have for other people that might be interested in this? And very quickly, you can see Lieutenant Tad Larson. Right here, you can just hit this little email box, and it'll send him an email. So if you're in a different jurisdiction, you can reach out to him and say, hey, I'd like to know more about your program. Can you help me set it up? Can you answer some questions? If this isn't exactly the program you're looking for, you're like, well, that's kind of it, but maybe it's like this. We have similar posts, so you can check out another similar program and read and see what they're doing in Washington County Sheriff's Office. So, you know, the problem that this was trying to address, we always go to these conferences and we hear great ideas, and in fact, there's one at the end of this week. shameless plug for the Justice Reinvestment Summit. But we go to these conferences and we hear great ideas, and you get really enthusiastic about all the things that are happening across Oregon and across the country. Well, this is a depository. This is a place that is completely searchable, and you can find out what's happening in Oregon and connect you to people who are doing these things, who are facing the same challenges that you're facing in your local jurisdiction. And there's just no reason that we shouldn't be able to connect these professionals together so that they can try to work on the exact same things. So this is something we're incredibly excited about. You know, I've gotten to speak on this nationally a few times at this point. There are a few states who are New York, Washington, D.C., the Vera Project. They're all looking at trying to build their own knowledge banks. So it's been hopefully a fantastic resource. I know that DPSST is integrating it into their curriculum so that officers who are starting to do research and do an evidence-based policing, instead of Googling, you know, what to do about mental illness, maybe they can turn to a Oregon-specific resource first. Because if you Google a program, you're going to find out what works for the NYPD or what works for LAPD. But that's not going to help you in Gresham.
No, it's not.
Right? So, I mean, the idea is just to get Oregon professionals together, share their information, share their ideas, and make some connections. So we're really excited about this resource. It's one of its kind in the nation right now. And it's hopefully just incredibly helpful to folks trying to get the job done.
Just a quick thing, if I
can.
We should talk. I want to make sure that this is not just known by the police officers. And not, it needs to, this is the kind of, these kind of successes we need to have shown elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are folks who don't believe that that's, I mean, there are police officers who don't believe that there's any other option that they might have. So I'd like to be able to talk with you a little bit more about that. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Frederick, I'll definitely follow up. I had a little OKB handout here, and I'll just quickly move this. We track every month, being a data-driven agency like we are, we track where our users are from. So you can see it's only been up for a year, but we have 12,000 different users, and we track individual users, 47,000 page views, and about 5,000 returning visitors. It is also fun to track this nationally and worldwide. Russia was particularly interested in our OKB for a little while.
I'm not sure that that's good right now.
So we do track this every month, and we see if traffic's going up or down. And, you know, like I said, every single month we're looking at this, and we see a steady increase of users. So we're absolutely in the phase of trying to get the word out. So, Senator Frederick, I'd very much appreciate to sit down and talk with you about how we can do that. You know, and just from here, I wanted to highlight that due to the Justice Reinvestment Program, the research dollars we set aside, we have four different studies going underway. We have the 416 program, which is a program piloted out of Marion County first, but now is up and running in Lane County. We are working on a randomized controlled trial with those counties, so we're really excited about that. We have a housing study in the works, a reentry program study, and a pre-sentencing assessment study. So we really are trying to, although we're investing the state dollars into these programs, at the exact same time we're evaluating them and seeing if we're getting the results that we're hoping to get. And it does take time because we're measuring recidivism, and it takes, you know, 3 years to actually know whether or not someone was did recidivate or did not recidivate. So it takes time by necessity. But hopefully the studies that we're doing, you know, 3 years from now, we're going to really know, okay, those interventions work. Maybe we don't need to invest more money into that one because it wasn't getting the results. So, you know, I think we're really trying to be as best stewards of the grant program as we possibly can. Just more kind of screenshots of our dashboard, so I'll skip through that. The sentencing guidelines is the other thing that our commissioners do. Representative Stark knows we every time, like I said, the legislature passes a law, we look and see where it ranks on the sentencing guidelines. If anyone would like to sit down with me and talk about what this document is or how it works, I'd be happy to do that. But essentially, it looks at the severity of the crime, the history, the criminal history of the offender, and that comes up with the sentence that the judge can impose. So this really governs a lot of the felony laws in our state and how they will be sentenced. We are the Statistical Analysis Center. We were recognized nationally this year for two different studies that we did. We swept the small Statistical Analysis Center category in the nation for research. They only give two awards. We won them both. So we were really honored and excited about that. Pictured there is Kelly Officer. If any of you have asked my office for any data or research, you've worked with Kelly. She's fantastic, and so is the rest of my research team. So we're really proud of the work that we're doing. And then we staff the Asset Forfeiture Committee, which is going to get going here soon. We put out an annual report on asset forfeiture, so I can hook anyone up with that report. And we were asked to do a 15% reduction. We're a small 11-person agency, so the bulk of our funds are pass-through funds that go to the grant program. So any kind of major reduction in our funding would have to come out of the grant programs. And with that, I'll take any more questions or get out of the way.
Mike, briefly, because we didn't really comment on it at the time, the proposed savings coming up of $191 million or something along those lines versus the governor's proposed budget of $32 million, roughly. Do you think that with that sort of a reduced budget that you can continue the level of savings that you've been doing with this program?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. We work with the counties every single day, and so they are watching this hearing very closely, and we hear back from them. And I mean, just we know that with scaling back the amount of money available in this program, they're going to have to scale back the services that are available. In some communities, that could mean jails and jail space, which is crucial to this program working. So I think any reduction in the program is necessarily going to reduce the efficacy of the grant program.
Great. All right. Mr. Ball, that was a long time to sit there.
We're going to switch chairs here real quick. Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, Dustin Ball with the Chief Financial Office. And in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over a few slides here. This first slide talks about the agency and their overview. We've heard for the last 45 minutes to an hour in detail, so I'm going to skip this. What I want to highlight on this slide are the governor's priorities for this budget. And the governor's priorities in public safety are really to ensure that those in the criminal justice system have the best chance to succeed, to deliver positive outcomes while reducing pressures on the state correction system, and to reduce recidivism. And you'll see these priorities reflected in maintaining investments in justice reinvestment, transition programs, and treatment programs throughout public safety. This next slide is going to give you a history of the agency's budget over a period of time. The far left is the 13-15 actuals. Moving over to the right is the far right is the governor's budget, and the middle is the current biennium. That big spike you see in the 15-17 biennium was an additional $23 million in justice reinvestment dollars when we jumped from the $15 million in 13-15 up to about $38 million in 15-17. And then there were a couple additional positions added within the agency when that additional investment was made. This shows the agency's budget in terms of what it takes to operate the agency and then how much money they're pushing out. That big orange piece there is 92% of the money is going out in grants and pass-through dollars. And then the costs of the people in the agency are 2.7, and then the operations are $1.5 million. Again, the key investment in the governor's budget for the Criminal Justice Commission is to continue investing in justice reinvestment as a targeted resource for the agency, and then there were some statewide adjustments that were applied. Those are DAS charges and attorney general rates were adjusted. And if there are any questions, I can field those. Otherwise, I can the other way. I know there's a lot of people waiting to testify.
Mr. Chair, my only question is that was a tremendous haircut to justice reinvestment.
Co-chair,
it wasn't a question, it was a statement.
Okay, thank you. And we will move on to public testimony here. I'm going to call you guys up at three at a time. My apologies ahead of time if I mispronounce your name. And a reminder that when you give testimony, give your name, where you're from, and we'll go from there. So how about Steve Berger, Brian, oh goodness, Idevi? Was I even close?
No.
And Andy Zimmerman. Close enough that you know who I was calling, huh? And why don't you go in order of call, and we'll go from there. And we have 3 minutes or so apiece if we want to make it through everyone.
Thank you, Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, and members of the Assembly's Ways and Means Joint Subcommittee on Public Safety. My name is Steve Berger, and I'm the Director of Washington County Community Corrections. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Correction Directors. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. I'd also like to highlight and acknowledge the great work that Director Mike Schmidt and the staff at the Criminal Justice Commission have done implementing the legislature's Justice Reinvestment Initiative. I would like to highlight the success of the state's Justice Reinvestment Initiative. Everybody's been referencing it as JRI, created during the 2014 legislative session. I know many will testify today and describe the successful programs, personal stories of recovery and such. However, JRI is built upon the foundation of a strong and fully funded community corrections system. Without that foundation, we undermine the proven JRI strategy. I note this is as the governor's balanced budget does not provide current service level funding for community corrections and triggers the opt-out within Senate Bill 1145. Senate Bill 1145 was created during the 1995 legislative session and has proven successful as evidenced through statewide in many ways through effective local programs, cost-effective interventions, and sanctions. The community corrections system that has grown as a result of 1145 has two critical benefits to the state. First, our system improves public safety by lowering recidivism, which means fewer victims of crime in our communities. Second, we save taxpayers' money both through improved public safety outcomes and cost avoidance. Oregon's community corrections system reduces our use for more expensive prisons and jails, reserving prison for the most serious offenders while still keeping our community safe. Today, I'm requesting you fully fund community corrections and the JRI because of our public safety task record. And remind the committee, we are one of the few systems that you can support that we know will save the state money in these budget-strained times. We also ask you to consider the unintended consequences and costs associated with a funding reduction in JRI and community corrections, which triggers the opt-out discussions in counties across the state. If I may, Chair Stark, in response, you asked Director Mike Schmidt a question, can the counties continue to provide the same level of services at a reduced funding from the governor's balanced budget. Respectfully, no. You reduce the funds, you reduce the investment, you're going to see an equal, if not greater, result in reduced savings. There's, you know, you can't reduce the investment and expect the same outcomes. The formula that Mr. Schmidt identified earlier in his presentation was that the expected, I believe the agency request by the Criminal Justice Commission was $50 million based upon the cost avoidance and the savings invested. Current service level today, I believe, is $41,200,000. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? All right, we'll keep going. I apologize for butchering your name.
It's fine. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. My name is Brian Imdike. I'm a community corrections manager with Clackamas County Community Corrections. And I wanted to tell you guys a little bit about how we're spending the justice reinvestment dollars in Clackamas County. First, we talk about our residential program. This is where we house our corrections substance abuse program. This program is somewhat unique from others around where we focus on both the criminality and substance abuse. We're not just looking at the addiction, but also the crime that's behind it and contributing to the addiction and keeping these people coming in and out of our jail and our prison systems. While they're there, they go through numerous hours of treatment, and we look at not only did they complete the work that we have for them based on their assessments, but are we seeing actual behavior changes as well to help move people through? When the clients are in our residential programs, they're assigned a peer mentor who's somebody who's gone through it in the past and can help guide them along the way as they transition through. At a residential program, we also have STTL beds so that people getting released from prison can go there and have a place to stay and get services to reintegrate back into the community. Also, talking about our new transition center that we just opened a little over a year ago, that goal is that our transition center, we have started to reach into our local jail with probation officers who are embedded in our jail who can start release planning and to figure out through assessments what these clients need so they can stop coming back through the system. We also work with our population who is living, community corrections population living on the street, and engage them in services so that we can provide interventions that they need to avoid these costly jail beds or prison days that they need to go to. Something new that community corrections in Clackamas County, we started working with these money is to work with people before they get on supervision. So those people who are at risk to get on supervision, either identified, self-identified, who we've identified ourselves, or through law enforcement, that we can start intervening with services at that time to avoid this costly journey down the road to intervene at this lower level. And I've also brought with me four of our clients who are currently involved in receiving our services so that they can tell you the story and help put a face to what actually is happening. If it'd be okay, can I introduce the first?
Please do.
I'd like to introduce first.
We'll go ahead and move forward.
Thanks. This is Angie Zimmerman, and she went through both our correction substance abuse program and received services at her transition center. And before, one thing I'd like to also say, our transition center truly allowed us to have full wraparound services. We can have a complete continuum of care to meet people where they're at and provide the services that they need, regardless of where they're at. We don't have to take the most severe or the least. We can tailor a plan directly to them and to keep the services going so that people can be successful and reintegrate back into society.
Hi, I'm Angela Zimmerman, and I'm currently on probation in Clackamas County. I almost have a year clean this month, and I have been through the Correctional Substance Abuse Program. I've been to jail many times, never prison, but what I can tell you what was different about this time was when I did get out, somebody was there to help me and give me resources and opportunities and also a place to stay, which was treatment. They also gave me I went through parenting classes. I got transportation passes, flu shots. sorry, I'm really nervous right now.
Great.
Great.
Okay.
You're great.
Also, job training, interviewing, classes, and and also support. The main thing was support for me. I'm in phase four right now, and I live in Oxford House, and I can still till this day call. They're open 24 hours if I need anything. They will pick up.
What are you doing now?
Great.
Oh, right now I am going to college full time to be an ultrasound tech. The transition center and my caseworker also helped me sign up for FAFSA classes and all that.
Fantastic. That's really cool.
Any questions?
No questions, but it takes a lot of courage to come and tell us your story.
Thank you.
And if I'm looking at this right, we have three more stories coming, right?
Correct.
So we'll call up
so much.
Matt
Thank
Gage,
you.
Hoyt
Thank
Cooper,
you.
And Gabriel Iverson. You made it look easy, huh?
Yeah. So let's run through.
Sorry. Okay, hey, my name is Matthew Gage. I am from Westland, Oregon. That's where I grew up. The last 6 years of my life, I got into heroin. I was addicted to that for a very long time with not an end in sight. In and out of jail, arrested for theft charges to PCS charges. Really at the end of my line. And then I got the chance or the opportunity to come to CSAP, which is an abbreviated term for Clackamas Community Substance Abuse Program. And there I spent about 7 months in-house from phases one through two. Had a lot of counseling from psychologists and upper mentors and peers. Had a place to stay, had a place to basically recover my mind, soul, and spirit. And then towards the end of that, I started going up to the transition center, which is right across from the jail. And up there, I met with employment specialists, two of them named Kimber and Shauna. And they helped me get my resume together. They helped me put into words what skills I have for employment, what to expect in interviews. And they gave me leads of where to go to look for a job. And now I currently work at Dave's Killer Bread. I have a year clean. I'm about to move into an Oxford house, and I'm truly thankful for everything that Clackamas offered me.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
My name is Hoyt Cooper. I'm 31. I had never really been in trouble until after I graduated high school. In fact, I played sports in college temporarily. After that time, I kind of started using drugs after I lost the structure of sports and was kicked out of home. I received my first PCS for OxyContin in 2006 and started to do good after that for a little while. Then I started using, kind of going through the drugs, overdosed on heroin in 2010. And then in 2012, I went to prison for 3 years. I did 3 years on a dropped measure 11. They dropped it down to 3 years, took off the measure 11 and the assault two. So I did those 3 years. I got out in March 2015, started using again right when I got out, because although I didn't use in prison, I also didn't get anything other than, the working time in prison and stuff to kind of keep me sane. And then after about 6 months after that, using real hard, I got five PCSs in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County. So I'm on probation, all those counties. I got another post-prison in Clackamas County. Then after the last time I went, Michelle Rickles, who works for our transition center, who comes into the jail to talk to inmates in the jail, came over. I had been mandated to go to inpatient treatment after that, and she advocated for me really hard to get into CSAP because it's just a great program, really. It's the only treatment program. I've been to three rehabs, three inpatients. It's the only one I've been to that goes over the cognitive and thought process behind the addiction, along with the addiction and the criminality. And I'm in the second phase of the program. I'll be moving on to the next phase here in about a week, be going up to see the employment specialists and talking about college and work and just everything ahead of me. And so it's just really changed my life as well.
Thank you again for sharing.
Thank you.
Yeah. Michael.
My name is Gabriel Iverson. I'm also currently a resident at the Clackamas Substance Abuse Program, so I live in the facility. I'm also a recovering heroin addict, about 10 months clean. And, you know, I just grew up nice middle-class life in Clackamas County. I lived in Milwaukee, Oak Grove area, and started using drugs when I was 15 years old. When I was 20, I got in a serious accident, was prescribed Dilaudid and oxycodone for a year, after which I'd become addicted to it. I started to use heroin, was in and out of jail for years. And this last time, last year in April, or May, actually, excuse me, Gina Calnon, who works for the Transition Center, came and told me that I qualified for treatment and they had a place for me to go live. And so I moved into CSAP afterwards, where I've gotten tremendous help. It's taught me a lot about myself, and the Transition Center has offered me all these services that I had no idea were even available to me, and one-on-one interactions with people who really, really genuinely care about me, even though they hadn't gotten to know me yet. And it really taught me a lot about the fact that I, even despite the choices I had made, that I still had potential, that I still had something that I could, I had choices I could make to make my life better. Taught me to believe in myself, taught me that I actually had some worth and that I could really give back to my community. And the most amazing thing that's happened for me recently is they've paid for me to go back to college. So currently I'm enrolled at PCC and I'm finishing my associate arts transfer degree this term. I'll be going to PSU later this year. I've also worked with one of their employment specialists, Kimber, who's helped me make a resume, and she's helping me find work that's in line with the school I'm going for, like the things I'm going to school for, which is environmental sciences and sustainability. So it's really something that it's hard for me to even put into words, like the help that they've really offered us. It's something that it's completely changed my life and my perspective of how the people who work for the county, they really care about me, and it's really just incredible. So thank you for your time.
That's fantastic, and thank you again for sharing your story, for all of you for sharing your story. Proud of you guys. Keep it up, keep going, and keep us updated on your journey. You know, this is we love hearing this part. So I'd like to call up, let's see, Chris Boyce, Shannon Wright, and Jason Myers. And remember, we're looking at about 2 to 3 minutes each.
Good afternoon. That's a tough act to follow. Those young folks right there, what this program's all about. Sheriff Pope, Chief, see, it's good to see you again. So good afternoon, committee co-chairs, Stark and Winters. My name's Chris Boyce. I'm a Douglas County Commissioner. And also the vice chair of the Association of Oregon County's Public Safety Committee and our local LIPSIC chair. So you'll notice, I think, that we're all going to have some real good things to say about this program today. And if you'll check OLIS, I know that some other counties have submitted some thoughts there electronically. Thank you for the opportunity to provide our thoughts on Criminal Justice Commission's budget today. We'd like to thank Director Schmidt also and his staff at the CJC for their continued work in improving our public safety system. AOC and individual counties have been privileged to share a strong partnership with the CJC, and I think we are making great strides in our progress, which I hope can continue. I'll admit, when House Bill 3194 was first introduced, I was pretty skeptical. I'm one of those guys who kind of grow up being very focused on consequences and thinking that consequences were always the answer. And we've seen that this program actually does work. This is a unique opportunity, I think, and coming from a county who's facing very similar budget challenges as what the state's facing this biennium, we're looking for opportunities just like this one at our level. This is an opportunity where when you invest in it, it's going to save you some money. So as a commissioner, I've seen the work that our public safety partners have done around making sure that folks are accountable while also receiving the services and treatment necessary for everyone to succeed. I think these young folks that just spoke in front of me are a perfect testimony to that. I often wonder what might have happened had they just been locked up in jail and let out and locked up in jail and let out and not had access to programs that helped them get through through some of their challenges. Justice reinvestment has helped our local public safety system in Douglas County work more collaboratively. Prior to the passage of the House bill, our local public safety coordinating council hadn't met in years. It's a state mandated program. We put all the people in place. They started doing the work. And as was mentioned earlier, all of us folks who are involved in this program locally all have full-time jobs. So we spend a lot of time doing what we do, and we don't have time to focus on this. We now have LIPSIC that meets quarterly, and it's talking about effective ways we can keep moving forward. We mentioned this earlier, through a partnership with the CJC and a federal grant, AOC has been able to employ 6 regional coordinators to work with LIPSIC around the state. Some of them are here today, and I hope you'll get the chance to hear from them. It's been wonderful to have someone on site doing this work. We have been privileged to receive one of these coordinators in conjunction with Josephine County. We share her 50-50. Just in the first month, the results have been very promising. You asked some questions at the very beginning about data tracking, and that's something that we've not had a lot of time to do at the local level, and this is going to provide you with that data that you're looking for. It'll also help us understand if what we're doing is working and identify opportunities for us to make future improvements. My anticipation is that with these new folks helping us, the results are going to improve exponentially. Just in the first months, the results have been promising. We now have the professional staff necessary to make our conversations and actions at the next level. Douglas County uses Justice Reinvestment Funds for intensive community supervision and substance abuse treatment. We have a similar program. We call it RSAT, which is residential substance abuse treatment. It's housed inside our jail. Produces similar results to the ones that you just heard. So, as one of the hard-hit timber dependent...
We're a little low on time, so
I understand, and I could talk about this all day. So trust me, it's important. You guys have a tough job to do. I appreciate the time to speak with you today.
Thank you, and I apologize for those that I didn't keep time better hour to give you guys more time. So, but we have to be somewhat brief.
Co-chairs Winters and Stark, members of the committee, my name is Shannon White. I'm the deputy director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a statewide nonprofit that advocates for public safety policy solutions that advance equity, healing, justice, and accountability. We're here in support of particularly justice reinvestment and their funding, and want to advocate to at least have it funded at the current service level of $41.3 million. I think, as you've heard today, there have been incredible outcomes here, and this is the kind of programming that if you don't keep funding, you're going to reduce the outcomes, and that's the minimum. And we are really acutely aware that you are facing a $1.8 billion budget deficit, so we don't ask that lightly, but this is the kind of investment that can really create lots of savings. And the numbers you saw from the CJC earlier, where we're projected to save $52 million in just operational costs, nearly $200 million in actual building costs. Like, this is a program that's having a huge impact for the state, and we hope you'll keep that in mind as you consider the funding for this. I know we want to be really quick, but you know, there's a really good example of how the data that the CJC has been gathering has been useful. There was a moment maybe a year ago, which I say with all respect to the counties involved, but where it looked like Lane and Marion counties were still sending a lot of people to prison. CJC brought that data, they had some conversations about it, and they really turned it around. So I think while we may be able to do even more with data, a lot's being done, and there's a lot of accountability in this program, and it's a great one to keep supporting. And I also also want to remind us all, really, that, you know, back in the 1960s and 70s, we deinstitutionalized the mentally ill, right? We found out that putting people in these huge institutions was bad for their mental health outcomes. And we were supposed to do the community investment part, and that never happened at the levels it was supposed to. And now all those people are in our prisons and jails. And so, again, this is the kind of thing where passing justice reinvestment in 2013 was the start. But there is no finish. We have to keep investing. We have to keep evaluating and make that commitment to the counties and the communities where we're expanding addiction and mental health treatment, where we're expanding community corrections, we're expanding access to housing and victim services. Those are all things that we've got to stay committed to because it's easy to forget, and we have a history of doing it. And I will just mention quickly also that some of our victim services allies couldn't be here today, but they did submit written testimony that I'll hope you'll take a look at as you consider this budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Myers.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm a Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association as well as the Chiefs Association, who fully support justice reinvestment and the CJC's budget. I'm going to be real brief. You've heard a lot of good stories today. You hear a lot of good things going on. My take of justice reinvestment is, in my experience in working in this legislature with a lot of you around this room, I've never seen one issue that brings sheriffs, police chiefs, county commissioners, legislators, victim advocates, nonprofit organizations, and businesses together to coalesce to make our community safer. And justice reinvestment has done that. The best example of that is the summit 2 years ago, where all 36 counties showed up. County commissioners, district attorneys, sheriffs, interested in making their communities safer. And I know that we have a summit coming up in just a few days, and I'm told that we're going to have a huge turnout for that. So this is important to the local communities. The work that's being done is very important, and the funding is vital to the public safety systems, especially the systems around our state that are so fragile. And you heard an example of one just a moment ago. So I know you have a lot of tough decisions, but these dollars matter, and they're making a difference in people's lives, and they're keeping our community safe. And they're creating these groups within counties that are focusing not only on prison admission, but it drives deeper than that. And in our community, we're looking at pretrial justice. We're looking at law enforcement assisted diversion program. So we've taken it beyond just justice reinvestment, and we're looking at all of our systems, our policing systems, and how we're making the best decision that has the best public safety outcome and the best thing for our community. So this is important, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today, and just ask for your support as you're looking at funding this.
All right. Thank you for sharing. We have two more left on the list. Walt Beglow?
Beglow,
thank
yes,
you. And Eric Block.
Beglow.
And I know there's a few members that are going to have to leave in 3 minutes, but we'll hopefully take it away.
No, I'm going to defer to the court.
Well, Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters and members of the committee, my name is Eric Block, and I am a circuit court judge in Multnomah County. And I'm here on behalf of Chief Justice Ballmer and the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm also speaking as the president of the Oregon Association of Drug Court Professionals. And I thank you for the opportunity to address you regarding a critical public health and safety issue, and that is funding for Oregon specialty courts. In the 15 years I've been on the bench, I've been privileged to work 12 of those years presiding over specialty courts. I just completed a 2-year rotation supervising our adult drug court called START, which stands for Success Through Accountability, Restitution, and Treatment. And but for the existence of that court in Multnomah County and the $12 a day per participant per day that this body gave to the Criminal Justice Commission in 2015 to 2017 to partially fund the START court, every one of our participants would almost certainly be in prison, and that's almost 200 individuals, costing the state not $12 a day, but $83 a day. So You know, specialty courts is a broad term, as Director Schmidt indicated, referring to adult drug courts, mental health courts, DUII courts, juvenile dependency courts, family courts, and veterans courts. And while targeting different populations, they do share an important set of key commonalities. They're built on this collaborative approach where the courts and the DA, defense, treatment, probation, all work together, sharing information and harnessing their respective authorities and expertise towards one supremely important goal, and that is the safety of our Oregon communities. Specialty courts seek to promote community safety that is durable, achieved through recovery and restoration of the individual court participant, rather than the often more temporary community safety offered through imprisonment and incapacitation. It's not right for every individual and can't be offered for every offense, but often it is the right choice for individuals in the system because of addiction and behavioral and mental health disorders. Specialty courts are not about being just nicer to defendants, or as the detractors of drug courts used to say, hugs for thugs. It's a particular model that was created and has been validated by the most extensive research and outcomes evidence ever assembled regarding any criminal justice program. The model relies upon sanctions and incentives applied to the right behaviors, delivered at the right times with frequent contact from the judge, to promote participant compliance and accountability with the probation and program requirements. The model over time initiates the court's participants into what we refer to as recovery, sobriety, pro-social habilitation, including work, and burgeoning integrity. And while I've said specialty courts have been highly researched and validated by what many people with PhD after their name, fundamentally these courts have been so widely embraced by communities both large and small across Oregon and across this nation in states both red, blue, and purple, it's because specialty courts embody a common sense, all hands to the wheel response to some of society's most difficult and topical crises. Addiction, especially regarding the burgeoning epidemic of opiates, mental health disorders, homelessness, chronic unemployment and underemployment in convicted felons. And these specialty courts have been so embraced by the participants of the courts because these courts meet what these same PhDs have identified as the essential needs of human beings: to be seen and to have supportive connection with others. Studies done nationally and here in Oregon show that for every dollar expended on a specialty court, many dollars are saved in other system costs. And it's because of this success of specialty courts at reducing recidivism in a way that is cost-effective, collaborative, and in the best traditions of our Oregon communities. Chief Justice Ballmer and the Oregon Judicial Department have asked me to indicate the strong support of the Chief Justice and of our branch of government for the work of specialty courts. I don't want to take up too much
time. So, well, yeah, Judge, we are over time
over
at this
time.
Point, and okay. We still need to hear from Walt, but of course it's always difficult to cut off a judge.
And not that difficult. It's your courtroom.
And the specialty courts, I'm such a fan. I have a dear family member who, after 20 years on meth, it took drug court, and she's been clean for almost 2 years now. You know, it's fantastic work they're being done.
Right.
So thank you for sharing on it.
All right,
Walt.
Your Honor, Chair Stark, co-chair Winters, members of the committee, my name is Walt Begla. I serve as the Marin County District Attorney. I'm a commissioner on the Criminal Justice Commission. And here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys, I'm just going to go off script here. I want to express my appreciation for Mike Schmidt and his staff. They are incredible fiduciaries of Oregon's public safety investments, and they've done a great job. On specialty courts, we recommend that you don't do any cuts.
keep it at that 11-plus funding stream. Those are pretty fragile entities, and they have a lot of different funding streams to manage and keep their FTE and treatment alive. On JRI, this has been a wise investment. We need to realize those savings. We recommend respectfully that you fund it $52.7 million so we can keep getting the job done, and we will. We have fulfilled this commitment, and Oregon stakeholders in public safety will continue to do that. 416, that's Marion County's flagship. Other counties have wonderful programs. We don't send about 60 people a year to prison up front. What you will lose if you cut JRI, you will lose a program like that. We have FTE that pays a deputy DA. And so it really is a critical moment for Oregon to sustain these investments. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chair, just quickly, because he mentioned Senate Bill 416, prior to House Bill 3194, some of us actually were planning or working on Senate Bill 416. We could not get Senate Bill 416 passed through these chambers. Marion County, on its own, decided that the merits of it were good. And so thank you, Walt and Jason and my community, and going forward to something that we could not do.
And on that note, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 5005, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.
I love my county.
Thank you.